The following teaching is part 10 in a 20-part series by Dr. Ken Boa titled, Answering the Tough Questions About Life and God.
We're going to be looking at the basic question that has plagued people for millennia, namely, if God is good, why do evil and suffering exist? And it's a basic objection that's surfaced, and I think up until quite recently, it's probably been the most fundamental barrier to people. But I now suspect that the biggest barrier is a different question, namely, the exclusivity of Christ. That is to say, is Christ the only way? So what we have here is a very clear difficulty, and we're going to approach it head on. We're going to spend two sessions. Again, all I can hope to do is to skim the surface. That's all we're going to do. On the first side, God exists and evil exists and God doesn't, or God exists and evil doesn't, or they both exist. And when you move into that question, you have a simple flow chart that looks like this. The problem of evil consists of those three options. I can't think, well, there is yet a fourth option that neither exists, but I don't know of anyone who entertains that, so you don't need to worry much about that. So you have these three options we're going to look at. And if you can eliminate the first two options and argue that both God and evil exist, then you have three options within that. And namely, God is either less than evil, he's not as great a power as the force of evil, or God and equal are two co-equal and co-eternal opposites, which is dualism, or the third option is that God is greater than evil. And if God's greater than evil, that leads to a couple of problems. Then if God's greater than evil, how come he allowed it to start in the first place? And secondly, why doesn't it stop? You see the problem there? So that's just the flow of where we're going to head together in our time. And then we'll just kind of pick up where we left off, the option of theism. We're going to look at, as I just mentioned, those two fundamental questions, causation and then cessation. We'll also have a word to say about a couple of other things, about other possible worlds. Why did he create a world in which evil would even begin? And other things along those lines. So we're going to be looking at that. And let's walk through this very, very briefly. We won't spend a lot of time on the two options, first two options, because the first option that evil exists and God doesn't, we've already discussed. That was the first question. So we've already discussed the whole issue of atheism and so forth, but that there is a basic argument that's been used, and people like H.G. Wells, David Hume, Bertrand Russell have all kind of posed the following syllogism. They say the major premise is God is all good, he will destroy evil. If God is all powerful, he can destroy evil. Evil exists, what's the conclusion? Therefore, there is not an all-powerful, all good God. Sometimes people will say they'll just deny his power. Sometimes they'll deny his goodness. Others, the atheistic position, would just say that this argument defeats atheism. Actually, next week I'm going to give you an argument from evil that turns the tables and actually argues from the existence of evil to the existence of God. Now, I'm not going to tell you what that'll be. We'll wait till next week for that. But it's a very good argument. I rather like it. Give it to him next week. So let's take a look then at this first option that we've got. This evil exists and God doesn't then is the basic question you've got here is a false assumption that God should have destroyed evil by now and he has no good purpose in allowing it. That's what this basic objection assumes. There must be a whole library that you could fill with books that discuss the problem of evil and philosophy of religion, apologetics, and so forth. So once again, I'm just going to kind of scratch the surface, but basically the solution as I see it to this particular issue of atheism and this particular outline where they say if God's good, he wouldn't want it, and if he's all-powerful, he could eliminate it, but evil exists, therefore he's not. It's really the solution's understanding that God could have a purpose in allowing evil, and also that God will ultimately defeat evil when it is appropriate, and that there could be some purpose that we can have in God's allowing evil. But we'll look at that in a minute and unpack that a bit more. There's a pantheistic viewpoint, kind of an Eastern-oriented viewpoint, that essentially denies the existence of evil. Now, there are certain forms of Hinduism, Vedantic Hinduism, and also there's something that was found its origin in our own country that denies the existence of evil. Can anyone think of what that is? Christian Science, yeah. So you have those views. In fact, the evil cultural idea is that there's a relativistic idea, there's no absolute whatsoever, so we can redefine what that might be. But the Christian Science religion, as many of you may know, actually denies the existence of evil, it denies the existence of death, it denies the existence of pain. Now, the problem is, though, people's experience of those three things is rather persistent. And so one needs, therefore, to find some way of accounting for this uniform human experience in the face of those three. And one can say, well, it's all an illusion, you see. Malicious animal magnetism is the culprit, as Mary Baker Eddy used to put it, whatever on earth that is. But the point here is that there is the appearance of evil, but not the reality. I recall living in Dallas at an apartment building where it was across from SMU, and the woman who ran this building, her husband was dying of a form of cancer, but because they were Christian Scientists, she refused to allow him to go to a physician. Ultimately, he did, in fact, die. I don't know what you do at a Christian Science funeral. I'm not quite clear. Because you don't want to... you probably don't want to have one, because you'd then have to admit somebody died. So I'm not clear about that idea. But the bottom line is it's an evil. That there's an illusion of evil. But this persistent illusion, it rose by any other name, would smell just as sweet. In this case, it's just another name. You're just kind of renaming this. Because the illusion of evil, of course, would be an evil of itself. So you can never quite get around this problem here. There's always something to be battled, what that bad thing is, and so forth. People, by the way, cannot live consistently with this, as you can well imagine. It's really an impossible thing to eliminate. All you need to do, really, empirically, is to open up something you get every day. The newspaper. It doesn't take long to read about rapes and murders and violence and wars and so forth to get some empirical evidence. Only one day's sample would be sufficient. By the way, that's why it's been said, if it bleeds, it reads. If it's bad, you know, so if it's bad news, it's good news in that sense. You see, that's what you rarely find a lot of press about things that were nice and well done, except for some cute human interest stories every so often. But basically, we have an appetite for that sort of thing. I think that there's a sort of a psychic voyeurism on human pain that's involved with this whole thing, but that's another story. That might account for the new shows like Cops and Police Chases and bizarre and strange things that take place. People kind of maybe feel, well, I know I'm bad, but I'm not that bad. So I'm not sure what the psychology is behind that. Then there's the finitist position, which would say, let me go from there. Let me see. The evil, God exists and evil exists. And that if both exist, then you have God as less than evil, which is the finitist position. I say finite because God essentially is not infinite. He's not all-powerful, but rather... He is bounded, and because he's bounded, essentially he would like to help out, you see, but the problem is he isn't all-powerful because if he's all-loving, the argument would go he would destroy evil. If he's all-powerful, he could. Evil's not destroyed, therefore he is all-loving, but he's not all-powerful. What's the popular book that talks about that argument? You've all probably heard about it. Right. Rabbi Kushner lost his son, and in the process wrote a book dealing with the painful experience he had. And for him, there was a dissonance between his view of God and the possibility that such a God could allow evil like that to take place. So his solution then would say, essentially, that God's hands are tied. He really would like to help, but evil is a bigger thing. Usually, there's a variation of this view. The variation is that eventually, though, perhaps humans can help him out. That's not a real likelihood. You know, humans are only adding to the problem. Last time I checked, not really a part of the solution. But in any case, if God's had all this time to solve the problem and hasn't done so yet, what's your confidence that he'll be able to do so in the future? There's not a whole lot of hope in this viewpoint if he hasn't been able to do it yet. So your problem there here is that you have a very deficient view of God. Really, not a God worthy of worship, but more a giant creature than the infinite and omniscient, omnipotent God of Scripture. And again, the solution I'll be saying is really having to do with the source of evil and God's purpose in permitting evil. Is it possible that there could be a purpose in permitting evil that at first would not be obvious but could be in the mind of God, and that God will ultimately defeat evil? So that brings me to the next viewpoint, that God is equal to evil. It's sort of like an alternative that says that dualism, Zoroastrianism, had this view, essentially, that you had an ultimately evil being and an ultimately good being, and these beings being co-eternal opposites. The premise basically was this, that nothing can be the source of its opposite. And light can't be the source of darkness and vice versa. And the second premise is that evil is a thing, and if God were the only eternal source of things, he would create evil. If he created evil, then he's not good. You see the argument there? So the answer to this is that your premises are incorrect. The premise, for example, is that that nothing is the source of its opposite. I have a few comments to make about that. There's nothing, I could say, for example, that there is, just because we have opposite doesn't mean there's a first cause opposite for each. For example, take the concept of fat and thin. Although they're opposite, it doesn't say, therefore, that there's some kind of eternal fat as opposed to an eternal thin. You know, there can be opposites without having one causing the other thing. And furthermore, if you think of it this way, imagine you have the idea of one powerful force moving one way, another powerful force moving in the opposite way. What happens when they kind of are at loggerheads? Suppose you had the absolute immovable force in confrontation with the absolute immovable object. You're tracking with me here? This force is irresistible, and the object's immovable. Okay, what are your options? Either the object doesn't move, and therefore then the force was resistible, you see, after all, or the object does move, and therefore it wasn't absolutely immovable. You can't have it both ways. And really, even behind most dualisms, there's the notion that one will eventually win out. So this is really another issue that you can have with this. And furthermore, one of the other problems with this view is the supposition that evil is a thing. I'll comment on that in a minute. But actually, your definition of evil is extremely important here. And we're going to see how Augustine, and then later Aquinas, made the claim, and I think rightly so, that evil is not so much a thing but a parasite on good. That it's an ontological parasite. It doesn't have any existence in itself so much as it's a distortion of an existing good. And so let me make a comment about that in just a minute. So that brings us then to the third alternative, that God would be greater than evil. Of course, this is where you have your first class problem once again. Okay, if God's all-powerful, what's the issue there? Then he would be able to overcome evil or keep it from starting, so the argument would go. If God is all-loving, what would be your conclusion there? He would want to defeat. He wouldn't want evil. Would you all agree with that? Evil exists. Both God and evil exist. Your conclusion? Then how can it be that God's all-powerful and all-loving? So this is what we're going to be looking at, and particularly focusing on these two issues, the causation of evil and then the cessation of evil. And there's also another issue in between. It's the continuation, but really that's kind of a subset of cessation. How did it start? Why is it continuing? And why doesn't it stop? What could be possibly the reason why God, if it started, wouldn't have stopped it right from the get-go, rather than let this cancer, this disease, spread throughout the cosmos? Now let's take a look at this, and I'm going to be talking about several things along this way. And we're going to talk about the definition of evil, and I just described evil before as a sort of a lack or of a good thing, either between in some good thing or between two good things. And so what we're seeing here is the possibility that evil could be, rather than something that is inherently a created thing, could be really a distortion in a created thing. You see, the solution is that God is the source of everything in the universe, but God is not something or substance, and therefore God did create all good things, but he didn't create evil. This would be the idea in Genesis 1. You recall in the Genesis 1 account, when he shapes and fills the earth, what do you see in the progression?
on, at the end of each day, what's the statement? And it was good. Good, 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 good. And then on the seventh day, it was very good. So he was pleased with the final product. The consummation of his creation was the creation of humanity. And he said, that was very good. Please understand then, according to the biblical vision in Genesis 1 and 2, something has radically changed in the human nature. Because when we come to Genesis 3, something dramatic occurs. It's called the fall. And the Genesis 3 account of a moral agent making the choice of self versus God, self over God, my will be done rather than thy will be done. This fundamental choice then makes all the difference and has profound rippling consequences throughout the quarters of time. And in a very real sense then, all of us inherit that. All of us have in one way or another been a part of this. This is a disease that spread virtually from generation unabated to the next generation and so on down to the present time. And one of the things that we observe in human nature when we look at people is that you never have to teach a kid to say me and mine. Have you noticed this? Never teach him that. What do you have to teach him to do? Share, Johnny. You should share with your little sister there, Johnny. No, it's mine. She's not, nothing doing. And you can also look at a child, and you always have to say, I remember Sesame Street, you know, cooperation, you know, and teaching kids to have a little measure of altruism, the selfish little creatures. turns out, we are just as selfish, only we're sometimes a little bit more subtle about that. You see, we're just more painfully obvious with the kids what's actually writ large on human nature all the way across the board. As we've said many times, in my view, the fundamental problem with any relationship comes down to this one word, selfishness. At the end of the day, the basic root cause of problems in any relationship, whether it's marriage, friendship, parenting, you name it, is going to come down to the issue of selfishness. My will over your will. Or my desire to change you, of course it's for your good, to correct you, to modify your behavior, that sort of thing. You see how this works? And so consequently we have this clash of wills that really originated with the first clash of wills. Namely, when the statement was made, my will, not thy will, be done. By the way, the temptation was a clever one, because in the garden, in Genesis 3, the temptation had to do with the notion, as Satan tried to do it to the serpent, God's holding something back. See, if he really loved you, he'd let you in on the whole business of the nature of evil. He tells you not to eat of the knowledge of the tree of good and evil. What's he holding back, you see? What's he trying to keep from you from having? So the fundamental issue that always leads to disobedience is a lack of trust and the mindset that we have a better idea than God what our best interest looks like. It always keeps coming back to those basic notions. And so in the belief then that this was in fact the solution to human felicity by finding our own course of action rather than God's, the blast of the fall led to profound consequences, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But essentially, I'm going back to this notion that evil is really a lack of something or an absence of something that ought to be there. For example, sight in humans, the fact that a stone has no sight is not problematic, but the fact that a human might not have a sight when they were designed to do so would seem to be some kind of a lack of a good that could otherwise have been there. That there is a corruption of good, that, as I said before, evil really becomes a parasite on being, an ontological parasite. It derives its existence from that. So that you have sickness as really a lack of something. What's the lack? It's a lack of good health. It's taking something and distortion, some kind of a malfunctioning, some dis-ease is going on. Or if we can think of it, it's not merely a negative, unreal thing. Unhealthy, we could say, what other words do we use? We say unsanitary, unreliable, he's uncivilized, he's unkind, he's unloving, impatient. All these are terms we use to describe evil things. And it turns out even a murderous action, when analyzed, can be reduced to a distortion of a proper motive, or a proper idea of a thing that a person could have, a desire for some kind of a gain, but it's distorted and twisted, and so ultimately this parasite takes place. But it has no ultimate reality in and of itself. When you think about the idea of a rotting car, there's no such thing as an absolute rotting car. Once you run out of metal, there's nothing more to rot. A corpse the same way. This sort of idea of this parasitic notion was then seen that evil was a privation, either in a good thing, or a privation or a lack between two good things, for example, in people. The lack of harmony and concord and goodwill and shalom. Something's missing. Something is not there that ought to be there. So if this is true, evil then is the negative and good is the positive, but they're both real. But evil is a real lack in some good thing. And therefore, looking at this way, we can see that God is not the one who is accountable for its existence. And but we go further, where then did it come from? And we can say that the source of evil really has to do with the free will defense that's been used since since the 4th century. And the free will defense then makes the claim that there's always a choice, and the most fundamental thing about you and me, the thing that really makes us most in the image of God, is that we're moral agents whose choices really do shape reality. That it's not a sham. Imagine a world, for example, in which God were to intervene at every point and every place when you chose to do something nasty to a friend or to another person. So you tried to shoot them, and the bullet turns into a marshmallow. Or you drive recklessly and take a turn too quickly, and a gust of wind miraculously comes back up and pushes your car back on the road. You try to beat somebody over the head with a hard object, and it turns into a noodle. Now, such a world, then, would have the appearance of choice, but not the reality, because such choices never have consequences. And without consequences, a thing's not really a choice. It's only the appearance of a choice. Do you see the nature of this? Herein lies the dilemma. It's the dilemma of free agency vis-a-vis love and choice. Because in creating a free agent, there's always the possibility of rejection. This is why people who've been hurt in love, their natural temptation is to do what? You tell me. What's the natural temptation?
Not get involved.
Don't want to go through that again. It's not worth it. I have enough problems of my own. I don't need to mess up my life with somebody else and their agenda. What happens, though? You get lonely, things happen, and then you go right back into the deal and say, how did I do this again? But you see, here's the problem you've got. You see, it's like two porcupines on a cold night. You see, so they huddle together to get warm, and as soon as they do, they push each other away and back and forth, like a yo-yo. And this is a problem in our relationships. And I think C.S. Lewis put it so well when he said, you know, the only place where you can be absolutely safe from all the dangers and perturbations of love is hell. There you don't have to worry about being hurt again by another human being, you see, because everybody will be in their own little black hole of self. And so the consequences then are, even when we look at Earth, when a person tries to back off and put that carapace, that hard carapace around, and protect themselves from people's agendas, you know what happens? It basically leads to a life that has no meaning, no purpose, no quality, no substance, no value. And so this is the dilemma that we have. The only solution, really, to quality relationships is a heart transplant, a transformation, a change in human nature. Is it possible, then? Is there something that can actually change us so that we become other-centered rather than merely self-centered? Is there something that can dynamically cause us to, in fact, put the interests of others above ourselves? And I argue, of course, that there is. But it'll take something beyond the human condition to make that available and possible, and that brings God into the picture. And, of course, when you're bringing God into the picture, you realize that there are various dimensions of this problem. In fact, let me go back for just a minute and show you that there are three aspects. There are really three essential answers to the problem of evil and suffering. The first answer, and we're kind of looking at this initially, is a sort of what we might call philosophical answer. And the philosophical answer is where we're going with Genesis 3, this whole idea of that there is the free will defense, but there's also a theological answer, and this deals with the book of Job. And we're not going to get into the book of Job, but the bottom line there has to do with the sovereignty of God, and there are dimensions here that transcend human comprehension, that there is, in fact, a mystery. Job, you recall, never did get an answer to why he was suffering. Do you recall how that worked out? You and I have a privileged access to Job chapter 1 and 2, but he didn't. You see, wouldn't it be great if any time you suffered, you could see the Job 1 and 2 of your life? In other words, the background, this is what happened here. That'd be great, but you're not going to see that this side of eternity. It would also be nice to see Job chapter 42, how it all ends up. Remember how it ends very well? Not that the book is making the claim that always it'll always be well on this planet, because you're not really home until you are in your heavenly home when you're a follower of Jesus. But the ultimate idea is that it'll all be well. It'd be nice to have it bookended like that, but the book itself shows us that Job's understanding was actually in between, and that he didn't have a full orbed grasp. But one thing he did learn about was the sovereignty of God and the folly of human intentionality, making the claim that God, when he goes in a way that is contrary to my intentions and my desires and my purposes, must not be doing something right. We also then have what we might call a devotional answer, or we could call that a personal answer. And the personal answer, and this is where it really comes home, is in the person of Christ. C.S. Lewis, when he wrote The Problem of Pain, focused much more on these two issues. But when after he lost his wife, Joy Davidman, you recall then that he wrote another book, anonymously at first, and then it was later, of course, realized it had to be Lewis. The style was clearly his. And it was A Grief Observed. And there he expressed his own pain, his own anguish, his own disappointment, one might say, with God. His own dashed expectations, even though he knew in marrying her that he was committing himself to this kind of pain, and understood this. But you have a man struggling, not losing his faith, but rather struggling with this issue. And I'll tell you this, when you want to deal with the philosophical problem, these things are helpful, but when it comes down to your own personal suffering, when you deal with those issues, then the idea that there is a God who understands the human condition because he entered into it. The idea that we do not have an unfaithful high priest, but a faithful high priest who has suffered just as you and I have, who's entered into the human condition, who knows what it's like to be rejected, who knows what it's like to be abused and beaten and bruised and spit upon and mocked and finally killed by those whom he loved. You understand the idea then that God can empathize with our condition because he entered into it and, we'll see, underwrote the cost himself so that it would become possible then for us to actually enjoy a right relationship first with him and then with ourselves by consequence, and then as a result the ripple effects would be then a right relationship with other people. It was Thomas Merton said that the human condition can be summarized really in two sentences. In one sentence is that we do not have peace with ourselves because we do not have peace with God, ultimately. And because we do not have peace with ourselves, we do not have peace with others. The idea here is that the right relationship with God will redefine who and whose we are, and then make it possible and give us resources in order for us to have peace with other individuals. So we have these dimensions here, but let's return back to where we were. Again, we're looking at this whole business on the problem of evil, the source. I'm going to be arguing then that there is a source that Scripture affirms, that is the issue of free will. And going back to that, I would like to suggest that the nature of a choice, the importance of a choice, has everything to do with the consequences. Now, we live here in Atlanta, but I have to tell you, the consequences of choosing between Coke and Pepsi aren't really that great. Now, I know that some people might well disagree with this, but really they're not that great a consequence. But the consequences of the choice between Coke and, let's say, cyanide, that's another matter. You see, then there are some serious consequences as to which you choose. Suppose you had two Cokes. One is an ordinary Coke, and the other one's laced with a couple of drops of cyanide, which is more than you'll need. They shake it up well, there you can't tell the difference. That choice, you know, will be of great consequence indeed. And so I'm suggesting, what could be the greatest choice that one could ever make? And the one that would have the greatest consequence? Tour away from God. If God is the one for whom we were made, and He's the one who spoke the cosmos and the being, then clearly the decision to turn to or away from Him would not only be the most important choice, but it would also have the greatest consequences, because the Scripture said, in the day you eat thereof, you shall surely die. And first it was a spiritual death. Remember, death in Scripture is not annihilation, but separation. That you'd be separated from God, but that separation, that spiritual death, would ultimately manifest itself in the physical realm of physical death, which is separation of the soul from the body, and that you will die doubly. And so this terrible consequence was seen in Genesis 3. Cursed is the ground for your sake. And so even the natural order was distorted. And now, as a consequence, we now live in a disease-death environment. Neither nature nor ourselves are as God made them. They have been distorted. They have been changed according to the biblical vision. So it had profound consequences. So this is the thing that God creates, then, is the ability to make what we might say free will. Now, when I say free will, I'm going to bracket that. Nobody has absolute, total freedom. Only God has that kind of freedom. You don't have freedom, for example, to walk through that wall. There are some things you can and cannot do. But within those boundaries of human choice, there are some choices that you can make that really do count. So it's an ability to choose between one thing and another, between good and evil. And so it creates the capability, though, of actualizing evil, but not necessarily evil itself. Therefore, God did create the possibility of evil, but we created the actuality of evil. Do you see the idea there? The possibility. The possibility of an evil is not an evil itself, if it's also the possibility of a greater good, and God must always do His best. As I look at the Scriptures, then, we will look and see the bigger picture, that the evil that we will see in the Genesis 3 account, and then comparing that with the Revelation 21 and 22 account, will show us that ultimately, while this is not the best of all possible worlds, have you noticed that lately? There are some very easy ways to seeing better looking worlds. Nevertheless, Scripture affirms that this is the best possible way to get to the best possible world. And we'll be seeing that there is a teleology, a purpose, a directedness in the sovereignty of God that somehow will be capable, so great is He, of taking human choices, even those that are against Him, and turning it ultimately to a greater good. And this is part of the mystery that we see in concerning the cessation of evil. Now, I say that evil, though, certainly has a great risk involved. What's the risk here is that God can choose to make people who are personal and agents who are like Him. I mean, there's no pleasure in creating a robot. When you think about the HAL 9000 computer, remember in 2001? How many of you remember the 2001 A Space Odyssey? You know, most of you saw it. Oh, it was a cutting edge deal when it first came out. You know, everything, it changed all the rules. And you recall the HAL 9000 series was just couldn't really go wrong. It was designed to where he would always repair himself and always make good decisions. And you recall the horror of realization that HAL had his own ideas as to the mission, and he did not want that particular mission to be aborted. And if these people decide to abort the mission, he'll abort them first. You recall that? And was rather successful in doing that. Turns off the life support devices for those who were in suspended animation. Then he proceeds to prevent the pod from coming back in. Remember, open the escape door, pod, HAL. HAL's silent. Remember that whole business? HAL comes in. So when he finally does get in there, he says, he starts, remember, pulling out memory sequences. Stop, Dave. Stop. Stop, Dave. Dave, you're making a mistake, Dave. But you see this horror of this idea of creating a creature, or as it were, an artificial intelligence that can make its own decisions. Well, you think you already have one. It's your personal computer. So you think. All that is, though, it's simply doing what you're telling it to do. You make the blunders, or the software has the blunders. All kinds of glitches are going on there. But please be assured, the thing really doesn't have a maniacal intention to destroy your life. Your computer really doesn't have that kind. I know we attribute that to our AR computers, just like we want to kick the thing and so forth. There's a plot against this. But the reality here is that we have a lot of literature. The Gollum legend, for example, and the Frankenstein idea, and lots of other images of creation of something that goes wrong, something that becomes uncontrollable. And what that, I think, really goes back to is the creation of an agent that really can respond or in acceptance or rejection. So if you stop and think about this, that can be somewhat frightening. But on the other side of the coin, suppose you create a being that has no option but to say, I love you. Some of you may remember when you were very young, some of the women here, I hope it's not the men, playing with the little doll that said, I love you, Mommy. And the little dolls, you know, you pull a string out and it would say that. I have to admit that that's not a very satisfying thing, and even a two-year-old can, after a while, catch on that this isn't really a personal relationship. They're not that dumb. You begin to realize that this thing really doesn't have a real rich form of interaction with me here, that you'd rather play with other objects and you attribute intelligence to the thing rather than this silly thing. You pull a string out and it talks and it says, I love you, Mommy. The point here is that that kind of relationship, wasn't there a movie like The Stepford Wives? Remember that deal? That's a scary thought. Remember that? Yeah. So they always perfect, always look just great. Everything's neat as a, you know, neat as a pin and so forth. And there's no relationship at all. You can begin to see that's not a satisfying relationship either. There's no relationship at all when there cannot be any possibility of rejection or a different perspective or turning away. That's the risk of love. So I claim then that in creating free will, that God permits people to choose this, and he permits some evil, but he never promotes this evil. The permitting of some evil is not an evil, but if God can achieve a greater good, then God always must do his best. So we go on to another thought, and that is the problem of free will. Question, what caused Lucifer to sin? I mean, he didn't have some serpent hanging around telling him about God holding back. Remember, you see the problem? And I have to say that he had no imperfection from within and no temptation from without. The answer is that there isn't any real clear answer. It's a mystery. The mystery is most clearly mentioned in Ezekiel 28 when it says, you corrupted your reason by virtue of your splendor. And that because of your beauty, your pride lifted you up. And you actually entertained the illusion that you could actually compete against the living God. So that you were your own beauty. And I have to believe that this, what he's called a covering cherub. If this is true, then, if Ezekiel 28 can properly be attributed by extension or application to this being, that Satan was of the order of beings called cherubim, and that he was, I suspect, the most powerful being God had ever created, the most intelligent. Someone once described him as tastefully dazzling. Not a bad way of putting it, that he was exquisite and had the illusion. But frankly, he sinned because he used his free agency, and chose to rebel against God, and we have a bad relationship between two beings, an infinite and a finite. But let me go on to another thought, and that brings me to the next stage here, if I can find my little sheet. This thing has a way. I tell you, the thing has a mind of its own. It's evil. The purpose of evil. Why does God permit it, then? Is it possible? I mentioned earlier that the solution was that there could be some good purpose, and that the other assumptions are that there can be no good purpose in evil. I say that there are three reasons. One is that some forms of evil preserve human freedom. Some evil, as we've seen, is the result of our own free choices. So when we can think about this, this can be caused by a person taking drugs. It can become overeating, under-exercising, any number of things. Bad decisions that we make can lead to a good deal of pain. I think we're all aware of that. Nobody gets up in the morning wanting to shoot themselves in the foot. But at the end of the day, you've shot yourself in the foot. How did it come about? Some forms of evil prevent greater evil. And in the idea that, by the way, but before I go back, going back to preserving human freedom, most evil is the result of others' free choices. We got, if you combine the result of your choices with the result of others' choices, you have a pretty powerful combination. Now, when we think about this, we think about all sorts of things, mugging, hatred, violence, any number of things that you can see in the papers day by day. I believe, by the way, these two forms, the result of our choices and of others' choices, account for well over 95% of all evil, and possibly close to 99% of evil. There are some forms of natural evil as opposed to moral evil, things like volcanoes, earthquakes, mudslides, things like that, that cause people to die. And I take it that those actually can be attributed to a variety of things. In fact, many of them are attributable to human choices once again. The choice to stay in a place that's known to be dangerous. I got to tell you, you know, you're playing with fire when you're living on an earthquake fault. Because there's going to come a point where it's going to happen. It's not a question of if, it's just a question of when. Building a house on certain beaches that are known to be very, very volatile and so forth, you're taking a chance. Now, you know, and eventually, you know, maybe you may not in your lifetime, but eventually, some places aren't good to live in. And there are some other choices as well that are made, that people make, that are consequences of ancestral choices and so forth. So even a lot of these can be that. But be that as it may, preventing greater evil. Some evil warns us of greater physical pain. Can you give me an example of that? Greater physical pain. Can you think of any? You start to touch a stove, and it's incredible. Your hand's moving before your mind's even aware of it. I mean, you're impressive, the reflexes we have. You need them that fast, because if by the time you smell the smell, oh, this is not a good thing. This is why it turns out that leprosy is a terrible disease, because leprosy involves the lack of being able to feel pain. We thought previously that leprosy was some kind of a degenerative disease in the sense that it made the fingers fall off and that. But it turns out the fingers are getting burned or numbed, or people are going blind because they do not feel pain when you and I feel pain. Again and again, it will happen in some countries that a person could be putting scalding hot water in their eyes and not even knowing it. There are all sorts of things. People whose fingers are being chewed off at night by a rat, and they are not aware of it. These things happen. And my point here is that leprosy is a thing that eliminates pain. You'd think, gosh, I wouldn't want any pain. But frankly, you probably do want some pain. Because without pain, you're not going to be aware of when you're really in trouble, you see. And this is the issue here. How about, for example, chest pain? Or suppose you have you really hurt your ankle and you now can't walk on it without great pain. This is a good thing. You don't want to be walking on that. Because if you walked on it, it would traumatize it greatly if you felt no pain, and you'd actually cause it to become far worse than it is. Some evil warns us not only of greater physical pain, but greater moral pain. This is where Lewis says in his Problem of Pain, God whispers to us in our pleasures, speaks to us in our conscience, and shouts to us in our pain. Pain is God's megaphone to rouse a deaf world. You see what he's saying? How often do you learn moral virtue through pleasure? Let's be honest about it. Wouldn't it be great if you learned virtue and became a greater person of character as a result of success? But I'm sorry to say that as a general rule, we learn far, far more from our pain and suffering than we do from our successes and pleasures. And that is why he says, God whispers to us in our pleasures. He speaks to us in our conscience. He doesn't shout in your conscience, because you can steamroll your conscience. You can kind of repress that. But he does shout in your pain, and that you cannot repress. He shouts in your pain, and it will not go away. And the longer it's there, the more you're in a position, perhaps, to be willing to listen to a voice you've resisted all your life. That it may well be that the greatest moment of grace is when you're flat on your back and you have nowhere else to look but up. That at the end of the day, that God's severe mercies might be designed in order to bring out a greater good in the long run, which brings me to the third category, promoting the greatest good. That some forms of evil can actually promote the greatest good in two ways. I think some kinds of pain can be the condition for immediate moral perfecting. And when I think about a person like Johnny Erickson Tada, and she wrote the book Johnny, many of you are familiar with this book, she spent a long time trying to get healed. A lot of people, everybody was coming around with their own theories, like Job's counselors. If you have enough faith, then God will make you well. And all these simplistic, really just plain stupid counsel that she received. And she herself says, as it's been 30 years since that awful accident that left her a quadriplegic. And in this condition, she herself says, I wouldn't have it any other way. Now, every day, she struggles with their daily existence, and it's not an evil one. But there's a quality and a depth that everyone recognizes her about her that would never have been achieved any other way in her life. This is why Alexander Solzhenitsyn could actually say, bless you, prison. Because he spoke of prison as being that place where God got his attention and perhaps would never have really become aware of his true condition apart from the gulag. And so the issue here again becomes, is it possible that some forms of pain can be a condition for immediate moral perfecting? Mercy, patience, forgiveness, courage are virtues that are achieved in a context of opposition. And then I would say, furthermore, that it promotes the greatest good if some forms of evil can be the condition of ultimate moral perfection. That is to say, preparing you and me for the life to come. And thus, in some regards, causing us to transfer our affections from this planet and all its machinations to our true destination, which is to transfer our hope from the present to God's promises. And in doing so, then, could really move us in that direction. It's been said, as long as we remain as we are, a world without pain, disappointment, obstructions, and frustrations might well lead to such an increase of arrogance and hardness of heart that life would become insupportable. The tearless world of heaven is a suitable home only for we as we will be. It's an interesting thought when you look at it that way. That we're not ready for it yet. I think it was C.S. Lewis who also said that in our present state, the pleasures and joys of heaven would be an acquired taste. You wouldn't be ready for it yet. He's got to prepare us for what he has in mind. And so I'm suggesting here then that in conclusion, the greatest good achievable with free creatures is better for us and brings the greatest glory to God in time and in eternity. It's a hypothetical world, yes, where one could say that evil would not exist. It may be logically possible, but actually unrealizable, and maybe morally less desirable. There's a greater profundity than what we can see. Remember, it's like this. It's like taking a piece of a puzzle. You have a 5,000-piece puzzle, and you're given one or two or three pieces of that puzzle, and you're not given the box cover, and you're invited to tell us what the piece will be like. 3 pieces out of 5,000. How will you do? You won't. You'll be clueless. But we'll say, God, based upon these 3 pieces, I think that you don't know what you're doing. Actually, it's the other way around. You see, it's going to turn around, and we're going to be realizing the utter arrogance of us supposing that we can bring God to the dock and hold him in contempt, and to argue that he doesn't know what he's up to. That there's a hubris about that, a certain arrogance about such a thing. I'm suggesting as well that when we consider this world, and I'm almost through with this portion of my thinking here, for the person who asks, why doesn't God stop all things like war and things like that and evil? Why doesn't he stop all those kinds of things that we see in the planet? It's an interesting question, isn't it? Have you ever asked this question? Why doesn't he stop it? Well, have you ever thought this? If God were to stamp out all evil at midnight tonight, who of us would be around at 12:01? We're real selective about the forms of evil we'd like God to get rid of. You know, war and things like that. But how about greed and envy and pride and gluttony and the other things? Well, don't cut up all forms of evil, just those things that I'm not likely to do. You see where the problem goes there. Murder, but have you ever hated someone in your heart? You see where it goes? It gets a little bit more subtle than that. Turns out that criterion by which he eliminates evil would eliminate us. So we must not cry out for justice, but for grace. Ultimately, this is what we need. It's also a comment as well that that if God executed judgment uniformly, none of us would survive. And when we think about the real issue, we're going to be saying later next week, is that the real problem of evil is within our own heart. It's easy to talk about what's going on over there. The real problem is, how come I know the better course of action and choose the worse? You see, I have something, a division within me that's causing a problem. I would also say in the nature, going back to the moral issue, I'll go into that next week. I've worn you out, I think, enough. We'll talk about that. What we'll do next week, here's what we'll do. Next week, I have a word about natural